It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
More healthcare workers fall victim to the West African Ebola outbreak. Fighting persists in Libya's two biggest cities. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Sierra Leone's chief medical officer says Dr. Umar Khan is the latest healthcare professional to die from the West African Ebola outbreak. He succumbed to the illness Tuesday afternoon. Three nurses at the same facility east of the capital Freetown have also died of the virus. In recent weeks, several doctors have contracted the disease. The news of two Americans in Liberia testing positive on Sunday followed the death of Dr. Samuel Brisbane, a Liberian who died a day earlier at a treatment center on the outskirts of Monrovia. He was a senior doctor at Liberia's largest hospital. The World Health Organization says nearly 700 have died since February in the worst outbreak on record. In Cameroon, the issue is not Ebola, but cholera, where an epidemic of the waterborne disease has taken more than 200 lives in the past month. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports.
The epidemic follows heavy rains that triggered flooding. Cameroon's Minister of Public Health, Andre Mamafuda, told VOA a majority of people infected with the disease are children under the age of 5 and women. He advised people to drink only potable water and not get their water from rivers, which can carry the disease downstream. I have asked them to boil water from suspicious sources before drinking, he says, and to stop their children from defecating in bushes and streams, adding that people should not dig pit toilets near water wells. The hardest hit areas are Logonanshari and Mayosava, where safe drinking water is usually in short supply. Residents say medical supplies are inadequate, even though the government has set up emergency units which are consistently overwhelmed with victims. The country's Red Cross movement and the National Order of Medical Doctors have warned that if resources are not deployed to fight the disease, Cameroon may be in for a repeat of the 2010 epidemic, when the country had to deal with 10,000 cases of cholera. That epidemic killed about 4,000 people. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Maroua.
Cameroon's President Paul Biya Tuesday dismissed two senior army officers in the country's far north following a Boko Haram attack in which at least 7 were killed and the wife of the country's vice prime minister was kidnapped. Cameroon has deployed hundreds of soldiers to its border with Nigeria, but has so far failed to stop militant cross-border raids. Fighting continues to rage in Libya's two largest cities, a special forces officer tells the Reuters news agency. Government forces had to abandon their posts in the southeast of Benghazi after a heavy attack from a coalition of Islamist fighters and former rebel militia. Meanwhile, 2 weeks of fighting around the Tripoli airport have killed several people. Authorities say a fire continues to burn near the airport after a rocket struck a fuel tank and then spread to a second storage site. The president of Guinea has declared a week of mourning after a deadly stampede during a concert in the capital. The French news agency said the stampede Tuesday in Conakry's Ratoma neighborhood left 24 dead. A statement from the president called the incident a tragic drama. U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman, a week before an African summit is to be held here in Washington, spoke Tuesday about the benefits of boosting trade with Africa.
We're working with Congress to reauthorize GSP and to update and extend AGOA, which has been the cornerstone of our trade policy with sub-Saharan Africa since 2000. Under AGOA, exports to the United States have tripled. And as AGOA countries improve their business and investment climates, the stock of U.S. FDI has almost quadrupled. AGOA has also supported the diversification of sub-Saharan economies. Since 2001, non-oil, non-mineral exports under AGOA to the United States have increased almost fourfold. But at only $5 billion, there is much room for growth.
Mr. Froman says U.S. exports to the African continent supported 120,000 jobs in the United States and says Africa is increasingly important as its middle class grows and features 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies. South Africa's unemployment rate stands now at 25.5% as of the second quarter ending in June, the highest point in 6 years, with more than 5 million people out of work. Earlier, the country's central bank cut its growth forecast to just 1.7%. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberians in the United States mobilize support for Ebola relief.
Currently, Liberians living in the U.S. have been calling me throughout the weekend to see how can they support, to see how we can save other lives from destruction in Liberians.
Jeremiah Solonte, Liberia's ambassador to the United States. South African firebrand Julius Malema's Bokas is his third. A union spokesman defends the agreement decision that ended South Africa's latest strike. And South Sudan's government urges rebels to negotiate peace in good faith.
Our expectation is that we expect the rebels to come to their senses so that we stop this killing, we stop these violations which they have been constantly doing, so that we bring peace to our people.
Michael Makuei, South Sudan's information minister. Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is in London to talk about the state of the country, and a pretty good malaria vaccine moves forward. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's ambassador to the United States says Liberians in the diaspora and friends of Liberia are mobilizing support to help bring relief to their country, which has been hard hit by the Ebola virus. Jeremiah Solonte says Liberians are being encouraged to make either monetary or medical supplies donations. This comes as the number of Ebola cases in Liberia rose to 249 with 129 deaths, prompting President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf on Sunday to close most of the country's land borders. Ambassador Solonte tells me Liberians in the United States have been expressing concerns about the Ebola outbreak in their country.
Currently, Liberians living in the U.S. have been calling me throughout the weekend to see how can they support, to see how we can save further lives from destruction in Liberia. So the campaign right now is how can we set up the mechanism in place to be able to galvanize the kind of support Liberia needs. We have the Global Health Ministries based in Minnesota that have agreed to collect medical supplies and equipment that are necessary to fight the disease, to be able to ship them. In fact, this Saturday, August 2nd, they will be shipping the first 40-foot container of medical supplies they have gathered already. So we are encouraging all Liberians and friends of Liberia and all well-wishers to see how they can be of help in collecting material support for the Ebola fight. At the same time, the embassy is setting out an Ebola account for other people who might want to make some special donations to help support the fight against Ebola.
Suppose I'm in Minnesota or, say, Iowa, and I want to contribute. How do I go about doing that? Any specification of that account?
Well, currently the finance department from the embassy is currently working with the bank to finalize the account. Hopefully by the end of the day, that account will be set up specifically with strict guidelines, accountability, transparency, to make sure that all monies collected for the Ebola virus is used for that purpose. I'm making myself chairman for the Ebola response team from the Embassy of Liberia, and we will ensure that we account for whatsoever monies that will be collected for the Ebola fight in Liberia.
Many African leaders are scheduled to come to Washington next week for the U.S.-Africa summit. Is the president still coming?
Well, as far as we are aware, the president is making all preparation to come. Our delegation is having final meetings and putting all of the plans together, some of the cabinet meeting ministers who are coming along and attending different side meetings are all in high gear to come, but at the same time attending to the national emergency issue.
Jeremiah Solonte is Liberia's ambassador to the United States. He was speaking with me in Washington. South Sudan's information minister has called on representatives of rebels fighting the Juba government to negotiate in good faith so that peace is restored to citizens. The next phase of peace talks is set to begin this week in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Michael Makuei says the rebels are yet to make any concessions since the conflict began more than 7 months ago. In this interview with reporter Peter Clotty, Makuei called on the international community to pressure the rebels to make concessions.
This call came as a result of the last visit of the envoys to South Sudan in which they informed the government that the talks will resume on the 31st of July. And the last adjournment came as a result of the boycott of the talks by the rebels. So bearing that in mind, we call upon the rebels to enter the next peace talks, the next phase in good faith, so that we bring peace to our people and so. So this is because the rebels, up to now, their position is not clear. Last time they boycotted the talks because they did not want to sit with all the stakeholders on the same table. They demanded that the government should only sit with the rebels and the stakeholders should be consultants at the lobbies. This was against the provisions of the protocols and the agreement of the communiques and the agreement which was reached on the 9th May 2014. This is why we call upon the rebels to enter this coming phase talk in good faith so that we bring peace to the people of South Sudan.
The rebels have called for the withdrawal of Ugandan troops because they think that the Ugandan troops have taken sides supporting the government in the conflict. Why is your government refusing to adhere to their demand as part of the effort to resolve this conflict once and for all?
These are issues of sovereignty and they are not in question. They are unquestionable. There is nowhere in the world where the rebel group will dictate the government and say that this should be done so that we do this. This is out of question, number one. The government have made so many concessions to the extent that we have almost reached a stage of saturation whereby we will not be in a position to give any further concession. The rebels have never conceded in any way, but the government had been conceding all this time up to the last minute. So there is no way issues of sovereignty can be compromised.
You say the issue of sovereignty cannot be compromised. But if you reach the saturation point, then what happens?
What happens is that it is up to the rebels. This time it is for the international community to press on the rebels to ensure that they also concede on their demands.
So far, what would you say has been the expectations of your government ahead of these talks in Addis Ababa?
Well, our expectation is that we expect the rebels to come to their senses so that we stop this killing, we stop these violations which they have been constantly doing, so that we bring peace to our people, so that our people live in peace and harmony.
Michael McQuay, South Sudan's information minister, he spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. One of the spokespersons of the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, known as NAMSA, says its members, its more than 200,000 members, are pleased with the agreement that ended a four-week-old strike. The workers had gone on strike on July 2nd to demand higher wages. They returned to work on Tuesday after accepting a 10% wage increase for their lowest-paid workers spread over 3 years. Vuyo Lufele, Secretary General for NAMSA in the Western Cape Province, says the workers had to compromise on their demand for the employers not to amend Section 37 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement, which bars both employers and the union from renegotiating issues already agreed on.
We had the National Executive Committee, a special one, on Sunday. We did the assessment of the strike and the assessment of the negotiations. And the legal interpretation of what was already proposed to be the wording in terms of Section 37 was indicating that where we have organization and we have got plan-level agreements, we can still pursue issues or demands of workers using those platforms at company level. That doesn't mean that you must only have signed workplace agreements, but as long as there is a practice where you get your mandate from the workers and meet with management, where you have got monthly meetings with management, you can use that platform and still continue to place demands of workers. Then when you got that interpretation from the lawyers, it was clear that it's no longer a Section 37 that is in favor of workers. This Section 37 would also be in favor of us as NAMSA. On those bases, we felt that, no, look, we can sign the agreement if that is the case. And as a result of that, then we pronounced the strike off and workers went back to work.
Vuyo, the strike began by the workers demanding 15% wage increase. At the end of the strike, you ended up with what? 10% over 3 years or so. Is the union satisfied with what the workers got?
The signed agreement is on 10% for the 3 years, 10, 10, 10.
Are the workers satisfied?
Workers are very happy with the current agreement and with the current signed offer of 10%.
Was the strike worth it? And in other words, this final agreement, was, say, a betrayal of the original aim of this strike, or you feel that this needed to happen so that everybody can be satisfied?
I can say to you that strike had to take place in order for the employers to back off on what they wanted. Because from the beginning, you could have settled if employers were not demanding amendments on Section 37, amendments that would be in their favor completely. By going on strike, that had made the employers to make changes and agree to the weddings and so on, not to just have an agreement that would say there will never be demands placed by the workers for the duration of the agreement.
Vuyo Lufele is the Secretary General for NAMSA Western Cape Province. He was speaking with me from Cape Town. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The controversial South African politician Julius Malema has released a book entitled The Coming Revolution. Malema surprised everyone when his new Economic Freedom Fighters Party took nearly 10% of the vote in this year's elections. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg on the book and political ambitions of the young militant, which is causing worry with political circles.
The book titled The Coming Revolution, Julius Malema and the Fight for Economic Freedom, portrays Julius Malema and his party as the answer to South Africa's socio-economic problems. Those problems include corruption, unemployment of at least 25%, poorly operating schools, and chronic financial inequality 20 years after the end of apartheid. Speaking at the book launch in July, Malema repeated his populist stance.
In everything else we do, we seek to achieve economic freedom in our lifetime. And that is a strategic vision of the EFF, which we want all members of the EFF to internalize and appreciate.
Economic freedom, as defined by the EFF, would be achieved through a socialist approach that includes nationalization of mines and banks and the expropriation of land without compensation. In the book, which was not actually written by Malema, he does not hide his anger and hatred for whites. He says they must return the land that they, in his words, stole from the South African black majority. The message resonates with some South African blacks who are increasingly disillusioned by the failure of the ruling African National Congress Party to deliver basic services and by seeing the party of the late Nelson Mandela named in one corruption scandal after another. Malema himself has had his share of scandals, including being arrested and charged with fraud, tax evasion, money laundering and racketeering. But his appeal to the poor is undeniable, and that is what has made more established political circles and analysts concerned. That and the anger in the message, his confrontational style and potential for violence. In just his first week in parliament, Malema was thrown out of the chamber for refusing to withdraw a statement in which he said the ANC killed 34 miners who were shot dead by police during strikes in Marikana in 2012. In a separate incident, EFF representatives in the Gauteng province legislature were evicted by police for coming into session wearing red overalls and domestic workers' clothes. EFF supporters retaliated with a protest in which they forced their way into the legislature, damaging property and looting. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister and founder of the Movement for Democratic Change, Morgan Tsvangirai, is currently in Britain at the invitation of the UK-based think tank Chatham House to talk about the state of the country following the 2013 elections. Mr. Tsvangirai says he welcomes Britain's invitation as an opportunity to fulfill his party's strategy of global engagement and to inform the world about what is happening in Zimbabwe. He tells Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service he remains hopeful that change will come to Zimbabwe in due time.
The way forward is what we have proposed as the MDC, which is When a country faces a national crisis of our magnitude, you need a collective solution and a consensus as to the way forward, which means that you need national dialogue as a prerequisite to find common solution. In our case, the crisis in 2008 was resolved by national dialogue through the global political agreement, although, of course, it was later on subverted when it came to elections. But the whole process of returning to stability, confidence, and prosperity came out as a result of that negotiated solution. So what we have been calling for is that let's have all stakeholder participation in that dialogue, not just political parties, but churches, NGOs, trade unions, student movement. Because we face a national crisis, we should find a national solution.
ZANU-PF officials that we have talked to about the need for dialogue are saying no, Mr. Tsvangirai is desperate to come into another government of national unit.
No, far from it. I'm not desperate. Neither is the MDC desperate. We are desperate to find a national solution. What's wrong with that? Unless, of course, ZANU-PF is saying there's no crisis, as their president has said, that the economy is on the rebound, nothing to worry about, which has now become a laughing stock because everyone knows the state of the economy and the state of the people. So those who still want to bury their head in the sand, like the ones that you are quoting, can continue to bury their head in the sand.
Some ZANU-PF officials are also saying that in order for that dialogue to happen, you must concede defeat to Mr. Mugabe. Are you going to do that?
We have a disputed election on our hands, and I've maintained a position that under no circumstances are we going to have conditional dialogue. If people want to talk, let's talk, but unconditionally.
You are also saying the EU, when it wants to engage with Zimbabwe, must insist on implementation of agreed electoral conditions. Some are taking it to mean that you are saying the EU must maintain the so-called targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe.
No. If we say that the EU must engage on a framework, that's exactly what I mean. If the EU believes in democracy, believes in the rights of the people, surely those values will apply to Zimbabwe too. And if there is going to be a partnership, ZANU-PF government must reciprocate to achieve those values and ethos.
That was Morgan Tsvangirai, former Zimbabwe Prime Minister and founder of the Movement for Democratic Change. He was speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service from London, the United Kingdom. The first vaccine against malaria has taken another step closer to market. It only prevents about a quarter to a half of cases, so it is not as good as most vaccines. But for a disease like malaria, which kills 600,000 people a year, it may be good enough. VOA Steve Baragona reports.
GlaxoSmithKline's vaccine prevented just under half of malaria illnesses in children 5 to 17 months old, according to a new study in the journal PLOS Medicine. Epidemiologist Mary Hamill at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is one of the authors.
It's a pretty good vaccine, I would say. So we were looking for 30% or higher.
It prevented about a third of severe cases, the kind most likely to kill. Most vaccines are 80 to 90% effective or better, but no vaccine against a parasitic disease like malaria has ever been developed. Hamill says this disease is a special case.
So the burden of malaria is so high across sub-Saharan Africa that even with modest efficacy numbers like these, you can get a pretty high impact.
In places with high rates of transmission, children can get the disease several times a year. This vaccine could prevent a great deal of illness, she says. It prevented 27% of illnesses but provided no protection against severe disease. And Hamill notes it lost its punch over the course of the 18-month study.
It did decline more rapidly than one would hope, and that's why the impact of the booster is going to be very important.
The researchers will be testing whether booster shots prolong protection. Dr. Chris Plow at the University of Maryland School of Medicine is one of many experts saying the vaccine is an important step forward.
We don't really have a silver bullet. This is a first-generation vaccine, and we'd all like to see vaccine that has 100% protective efficacy, but in the context of how well we expect to do with a really tough disease like malaria, this is actually pretty good and reason for some celebration, I would say.
But tempering that celebration, Brown University malaria researcher Dr. Jonathan Curtis wonders whether a vaccine that prevents relatively few deaths will be worth the cost.
Who is going to pay to deliver this vaccine, which is not a cheap vaccine to manufacture? Will they pay to stop 20 cases per 1,000 participants per year and a half? And I can't answer that.
Several other vaccines are in development, but they are all years away. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the British Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. Joyce Chepkurui clocked 32 minutes and 9.35 seconds to lead Florence Kiplagat and Emily Chibet in a 1-2-3 Kenyan medal podium sweep in women's 10,000 meters in athletics on Tuesday. Later, 20-year-old Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon prevailed in the women's 1500 meters in 4 minutes and 8.94 seconds, while in women's 400 meters, Botswana's Amantle Moncho was fourth, followed by Nigerian Folashade Abugan. Meanwhile, in swimming, South African Chad Leclos bagged a bronze medal in men's individual 200 meter medley relay. Staying in Glasgow, South Africa is seventh on the medal table as at Tuesday. They have amassed 9 gold, 7 silver and 10 bronze medals. Kenya is 10th, Nigeria 12th, Cameroon 15th, Mozambique 20th and Namibia 25th, while Ghana, Mauritius, Uganda and Zambia share the 26th spot with one bronze medal each out of 33 nations and territories on the medal chart. Turning to handball, the Republic of Congo beat Uzbekistan 34-25 in the President's Cup action at the Women's World Youth Handball Championships in Skopje, Macedonia on Tuesday. Paraguay pipped Angola 29-28, while Macedonia beat Tunisia 23-16. Finally, Liberia football authorities have suspended all football activities in the country as a measure aimed at curbing the spread of the deadly Ebola virus that is currently ravaging parts of the country. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, July 30th.
If you please permit me to call on the federal government of Nigeria, the state government of Nigeria, and the local government of Nigeria, as a matter of urgency, to use an aggressive method of information to bring to all Nigerians their awareness on how to prevent Ebola disease. Prevention is better than cure, looking at the population of Nigeria as a country. Thank you, Comrade Mazi Patrick Kurokraf, who blew premises at Kane Arachuku in Abia State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The president of Guinea has declared a week of mourning after a deadly stampede during a concert in the country's capital. That's it for this Wednesday, July 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying, have a nice day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feed. VOANews.com.